All right, Acts chapter 23. We had concluded, or I should say, stopped our last class around verse 22, verse 23, after Paul had received word of what was to be done with him, because the Jews really wanted to take Paul out. They had been frustrated by him. They cannot find any reasonable way to stop him. And so, them being unreasonable people anyway, don't think nothing of going further into sin and unreasonableness. And so, they concoct a plan, 40 plus assassins that would be waiting to take Paul out. All the Sanhedrin, the council had to do was to call for Paul to put on a pretense that they wanted to question him more. But on the way there, they would jump him. And no doubt the soldiers that were with him as well. And get to Paul and kill him before he has a chance to be questioned anymore. Well, there, by the providence of God, happened to be one of Paul's relatives that was there that overheard this and reported this to Paul, and Paul told the guard to make sure that you take this relative of his to Lysias the commander. And he does that, and he shares the information. And so the commander really has not understood what is going on at all. This he looks as an opportunity to get Paul out of here. Just send him up the chain of command and let the next person deal with him. But he's going to send Paul with a note. I should say he should send probably the soldiers with this note about Paul. And there Felix the governor would be able to understand why Paul is before him. So that's where we left off. With this letter that was coming with the soldiers regarding Paul. Comments or questions about any of those past things that we looked at? All right. So, verse 25, it says, he wrote a letter in the following manner. Claudius Lysias to the most excellent governor Felix. Greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. Coming with the troops, I rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. And when I wanted to know the reason they accused him, I brought him before their council. I found out that he was accused concerning questions of their law, but had nothing charged against him deserving of death or chains. And when it was told me that the Jews lay in wait for the man, I sent him immediately to you, and also commanded his accusers to state before you the charges against him. Farewell. So Lysias sent the reason for why Paul needed to be before Felix. Felix was a governor. You know, Pilate at one time was a governor, a proconsul over the Palestinian area. Festus would be another one that's mentioned in Acts. Felix here is another. And so they have pretty much all authority in that area. It was about as high as you could get for that particular region. You know, answerable, of course, to the Caesars, but that was pretty much it. So, here we see Felix have an opportunity to hear Paul, and we'll learn that he actually had some knowledge about Christianity. Now, Lysias says that this man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. Coming with the troops, I rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. Anyone find fishy about that statement there?
He didn't find out that he was a Roman.
Right. And so he writes it this way because, well, it's a fingerprint of man, right? Man tries to slant things in a way that makes him look better than what he actually is. You know, share details of the story that make him look better, withhold details from the story that makes him look worse. And so we see Lysias here is just like any man in that regards. The truth was that he found out Paul was about to be killed and he didn't know why. And so he pulls him out And Paul says, can I talk to the crowd? And he says, go for it. But he talked in the Hebrew language. And so you get the idea that he didn't understand what was going on. But again, after they heard the word Gentile, there was a big uproar again. And so he takes Paul inside. He has him stretch out with thongs so that he might receive a scourging. And then it's Paul that informs the soldier that's about to scourge him that I'm a Roman citizen. And so having learned that, Lysias actually comes down and rescues him from his own soldiers. That's the truth of the matter. But Lysias doesn't share it that way. That certainly would have sounded unresponsible, right? For him to have about to have given the order to scourge a Roman citizen. So he writes it this way. He was being seized by the Jews. I come down and rescue him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen. So that was definitely not the case, but it made him look a lot better before Felix. You know, the Bible talks about deceit and talks about doing all things honorable in the sight of all men. That this ought to be characteristic of us. You know, Paul was accused in Romans chapter 2 of having done evil, that good may abound. You know, do some evil for a little bit, but the good will be in the end. And Paul said, no. That was slanderously reported of me. That's not the case. As in Romans chapter 2. And so make sure that we are also leading lives that are honest as well. Here we see this Gentile was not so. Verse 28, he says, When I wanted to know the reason they accused him, I brought him before their council. And so he had another session there. And what happened there was that Paul said, you know, I'm a Pharisee, and, you know, concerning the resurrection, I'm being persecuted. Well, the other Pharisees in the crowd say, well, he's our man then. You know, we don't want him being persecuted for that. He ought to be free. Maybe some angel did speak to him. And of course, the Sadducees that didn't believe in resurrection said, away from the earth with this fella, not fit to live. So Lysias realized there's some kind of religious debate going on here, which I'm sure has some merit in the religious realm. But in regards to the civil realm and secular realm and laws and orders, that really is out of our jurisdiction. So in regards to law and order, I found nothing in this man deserving of chains or death. So with that statement, he's essentially said, from my perspective, he ought to be free. You know, he'd be an innocent man. It was almost the opposite way our system works, right? Yeah, innocent until proven guilty. Well, he was facing the sentence of a guilty person until he could be proven innocent. Because Lysias thought he was innocent, not deserving of death or even chains, and yet he has chains on his very hands. So, verse 30, he says, when it was told to me that the Jews lay in wait for the man, he had learned about the plot, remember? I sent him immediately to you and also commanded his accusers to state before you the charges against him. Farewell. So, he said, I had to get him out of Dodge. I had to get this man out of this area because it, you know, our goal is to ensue the peace. And in Jerusalem, it was just a hotbed for terrorist activity right now. You never know what was going to happen next. You know, you could have some of those suicide bombers if they had those in those days. But what they had was 40-plus assassins that were willing to give their life in exchange for Paul's. Because they had put themselves under oath. We're not going to eat anything, not going to drink anything until this man is dead. So in essence, they're saying our life for his life. We're ready to die. Ready to die so that this man might die. So he knows he must keep the peace in Jerusalem. I'm going to send him over to you, that there can actually be a formal kind of proceeding. Remember with Lysias, he was just a commander over soldiers, you know, police officers in essence. And he was hearing both sides out, but that's not an actual formal proceeding. He'd have to go to Felix for that. And he said, I've asked the accusers to also make their way up there to Caesarea so that you can have a trial, essentially, to determine the innocence or guilt yourself. I remember Caesarea was like the Roman Jerusalem for Palestine. The Jews saw Jerusalem as the capital city, but the Romans saw Caesarea as the capital city over there. And that's where all the bigwigs were, all the officials. You also remember this too. That's where Cornelius was, the very first Gentile to be converted unto the Lord. And it's also where Paul eventually landed, made his way across from land to Jerusalem. So imagine within less than 2 weeks, the guy that you all were bidding farewell to is brought in with a whole bunch of horsemen, 70 horsemen coming in into the city. And you say, there's Paul, he's riding on one of the horses, and there he is bound, just like Agabus said. Just like we were warning him, just like we were with tears saying, don't go, don't go. Wow, that happened fast. It happened real fast. So it's interesting when you paint the details of the picture, when you have more of the story, which we're able to get as we study through a book together. All these things kind of taking place and coming back together again. There he is back in Caesarea. Any comments about the letter that was sent? That's right. That's right. I mean, that was very privileged information. In fact, you get the idea that even the Jews that would come and state their case before Felix weren't even aware of this letter. Certain clues in the text make you realize that this is just Felix's information and what Lysias had said about his side of the story. And so, right, the secular realm, the university realm, and of course the atheistic society all say, there's no way that could be done. That just couldn't happen. It's because they all disregard divine inspiration. Ultimately, the reason why Luke knows this is because God inspired it. Yeah, Luke didn't know, but God knew it. God knows all things. And gave him the contents of that letter that we might be able to read it later on. And again, like I said, you see these little signs and symbols of inspiration, the purity of it all, and how the letter is written, where Lysias looks better by putting the frame on the story this way. So like I said, a lot of those things just... If one's making up a story, they miss things like that. They don't make details like that. Those are in there because it's part of human nature, and this is what happened. And this is how God inspired Luke to essentially record what was private information. Anybody else? That's right. Yeah. He'd been there for a long time, about 20 years. Right, and we'll know that he'll have visiting privileges, and so they'll get to talk with him and see him. And so there is a good, strong base of Christians there that could be a support system for him to lean upon. I mean, prison would be discouragement for anybody, you know, even an apostle. But it always helped him to have those visitors, and also for him to still continue his evangelistic work, talking to soldiers that were in the prison, and also writing his letters that he would write from prison as well. So a lot of good can be done even in situations we think are not so great. Paul found himself in that too. Anybody else? Yes, brother.
Matthew 10:16 is the verse. Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore, be wise as servants and homeless as doves. So we can see that Paul had this wisdom that Christians should have. He was able to use what was lawful against his opposers, against his enemies. If we think about him saying, "I'm a Roman," well, that turned the situation upside down. And then we think about him saying, "I'm a Pharisee," and the ones that were going against him became divided because of his wisdom that he used. So their plot was messed up. And then when he found out that it was 40 men bound themselves under the curse that would neither drink nor eat, you know, till they had killed Paul, he knew what to do with that in the right way to help his cause. And so that's what God expects for Christians, to live right, but don't just walk in with a blindfold on. Know what you're up against, and know your rights, and know the right way to do a thing. Some people think a Christian can't fight back at all.
Right.
A Christian can fight back, but it has to do it according to the Word of God.
That's right. I shared that on Sunday, the old Native American proverb that said, "Cry out to God, but row away from the rocks." And so there is that part that, you know, we play while at the same time trusting God. You think God knew what he was doing in choosing someone like Paul, who was a Roman? Not every Jew can say that. In fact, most Jews couldn't say that. And they couldn't say that they were born a Roman citizen like Paul. And so that gave him the advantage to be able to come before governors and kings. And even there in Matthew 10, I believe it goes on to add that too, that you'll come before governors and kings. And so this is a fulfillment of prophecy from Jesus Christ about how they're going to get this message spread everywhere, so that nobody has an excuse to say, it didn't reach me. The Lord will get the message there. Anybody else? All right, so Paul has returned back to Caesarea, and it probably was quicker than everybody thought that would happen, but it did take place. Paul had goals to be at Rome, and he thought perhaps this imprisonment is now going to halt those plans, but the Lord had appeared to him the night before that you will still testify of me in Rome as well. And so the Lord had given him a prophecy again that eventually you're going to be in Rome. So Paul knew it. It was just a matter of time. It was going to happen. This would be a long road to get to Rome. In fact, we're going to learn that he's going to be in Caesarea. Does anyone know? Anyone read ahead? How long? That's right. 2 years. 2 years. You think about Joseph. When he received the prophecy from God that his family would bow down before him, that he would be someone powerful. When you're in prison, is times when you rethink those things, especially if you're in prison for a long time. And Joseph was in prison for at least 2 years as well. Seems to be a number that God has used before. God certainly can move someone out of prison quicker or keep one in there longer, but he was there for that time, and Paul could always lay back on that foundation that the Lord had promised, "I'll be in Rome." He just didn't tell me when. He didn't tell me when. And so the Bible is always true when it tells us to wait on the Lord. Wait on the Lord. It's a hard thing. That's the hard part, is the waiting part. But God keeps His Word. And so we can trust what His Word says. We see it will come to pass. Paul will eventually be in Rome. Yes.
We don't wait on the Lord, then we mess up and we sin, because as you talked about Joseph, we also can look at the other side of that and look at the great Abraham and Sarah, whom
when God says don't have a child. And they got inheritance. If a woman can't have a child, she can't have a child from a human standpoint. So Sarah said, okay, just take my handmaid and you take mine. We're going to have a child that way. And that's going to be the way the Lord is going to bless us. But not so. You know, that just caused all kind of problems. But still, in the end, God still fulfilled his word. And Isaac was born from a woman that was past childbearing age.
Right, right.
Menopause had long since passed.
You remember how long that was? How long you had to wait for that child of promise?
You talk about from the time of
From the promise to when the child was born. A lot longer than 2 years.
Oh, yeah.
More like 2 decades. 25 years.
Yeah, 13 years from Ishmael, I think, to Isaac.
Right. But you're right. When we try and force things, do things our way, we end up in a world of trouble. Because it's so hard to wait. But we even see that Abraham, one of the greats, had trouble waiting as well. So we're going to also run into that trial and temptation as well. But those that wait on the Lord, it says in Isaiah, he shall renew their strength. And so we can trust and believe in that. Anybody else? All right. So continuing on in verse 31 of Acts 23, it says, "Then the soldiers, as they were commanded, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris." Now, if you look at a map, Antipatris is about 40 miles north of Jerusalem. So when Paul first left Jerusalem, he left with how many soldiers? Anyone remember? All right, more than that. That was part of the soldiers. How many total?
240.
I'm hearing different numbers. 470, nearly 500 soldiers. And so that certainly would have stopped any kind of hint of trying to take them on. I mean, that was obviously Lysias' best plan, to try and stop this before it happens, that there's just so many soldiers that any kind of fight against it would be utterly hopeless. They wouldn't even get close to Paul. So that's a huge police escort to Antipatris. Mm-hmm.
The point of them was like bullies. And when they thought they had the jump on Paul, they were going to lay it on. But now he's fortified. You can't touch that. You can die trying. And they were cowards. They didn't show up for that.
Right, right. I mean, whenever you see a crowd of 500 people, that's a big crowd. But then you put all of them in armor and with weapons, it's just not even a feasible plan to try and take them on. And that was the purpose of that. But it goes to show how incredibly important it was to them to take care of Roman citizens, right? The citizenship has its privileges. And that was one of them. And so they wanted to make sure that this citizen would not be assassinated, but protected.
And so, he also went by night, so mm-hmm. They were just smart all the way around.
That's right.
All the way.
Right. That's quite a trek, right? 40 miles, TJ, that's a long, long walk to go on. But that's where they went to. They arrived there at Antipatris, and then we see verse 32, the next day they left the horsemen to go with him. So there's the 70 horsemen. So you imagine that the 400 foot soldiers, they return back to Jerusalem, again, to ensure the peace there. And then the horsemen go on with Paul to Caesarea. In verse 33, it says, "When they came to Caesarea and had delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. And when the governor had read it, he asked what province he was from. And when he understood that he was from Sicilia, he said, 'I will hear you when your accusers also have come.' And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. So there's, again, further procedure, understanding that he's within his jurisdiction to hear this case. He puts him up in a safe place, and he says, you know, obviously we cannot have a trial until the accusers are here as well. So when they come, then we'll have the proceedings. Any thoughts or comments here? Yes.
You know, it's been a day now since those, or a day or 2 days, you know, since the 40 people, 40 men have decided to take that curse. And, you know, I wonder if they stuck with it. Because I tried to find the verse, I couldn't find it, but wasn't it part of the old law that you made an oath to God, you had to keep it, or it was for sure by death, correct? I couldn't find it.
Yeah, I'm not. I can't remember if it was punishable by death. I'd have to look that up too.
But I wonder if they would have kept it.
Yeah, I would wager that none of them went hungry. You know, personally, they say that in the Talmud, which is the Jewish traditions on top of Scripture, that they had a caveat that if it was impossible for them to keep a oath, then they were set free from it. And so, but, you know, a lot of those traditions were established that would contradict, you know, Scripture. And I think just the idea of, you know, decency, you know, and honesty. You know, hey, I gave him a word. I need to keep it. But we see that, and nothing said about it, but I get the idea that they probably all felt they were free from keeping that oath. Yeah, unless they heard some of the 500 soldiers.
Well, they didn't know where they were going or why.
Right.
Only the captain or whatever his title, he was the only one that knew.
Except then the following day he would tell the accusers, right? So some of the rulers would eventually know. How soon that was, I don't know. But yeah, I do read that a lot of times, and I'll say, yeah, I bet those guys, they went right against their oath after that took place. So we do know that Scriptures talks about the, you know, making a rash oath, and that it's best to hold your tongue. Don't do that. You see that in Ecclesiastes, you see that in Proverbs. Anybody else? All right.
All these leaders, these governors, even the king, when we think about Pilate, Felix, Festus, all of them, to a man, really didn't want to obey the gospel. They acted as though they wanted to, but they wanted to see a miracle, or they wanted to be paid off. So in their heart of hearts, they didn't really care anything for this gospel, but they were just the one that had to preside over it. But they really didn't have a desire, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of times they would say, almost persuaded without me, or Felix trembling, quake, but it wasn't too repentant. So the trembling, quaking, the scriptures say the devils do that, but we need change. That's what God.
Right. Yeah, their interest was more surface interest. You know, it was head interest as opposed to wanting to change their lives. They, in a lot of ways, felt, you know, they're in their position. They have too much at stake. It would mean a complete transformation of life. Most of them had got to that position because they were crooked. I mean, just think about Felix. Anyone do any reading on Felix? Good or bad guy? Bad. Real bad. I mean, murderous bad. And the Jews couldn't stand him either. He was killing their priests right and left. You know, if there's any kind of riot that broke out or anything, like, for example, what happened with Paul, if Felix had been there in other occasions, he just eliminated both sides. And he didn't care, you know, who was right or wrong. He just took them all out, just slaughtered them. And so he didn't get a reputation of being a friend of the Jews. And so they really actually hated him very deeply. But this is kind of who he was. He was a very brutal individual, an adulterous individual. From what I understand from history, he didn't have any right to be with the woman that he was with. And so he had definitely many sins under his belt, but God, in His grace, gives him an opportunity to hear the gospel from none other than the mouth of the Apostle Paul. Because God graciously gives individuals chance. But He can't make them choose it. It's only up to the individual. Any other thoughts before we go into Acts 24? All right. Chapter 24, verse 1. It says, "Now after 5 days, Ananias, the high priest, came down with the elders and a certain order named Tertullus. These gave evidence to the governor against Paul. And when he was called upon, Tertullus began his accusation, saying, 'Seeing that through you we enjoy great peace and prosperity is being brought to this nation by your foresight, we accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness.'" And after me just saying everything I said about him historically, what you got here is a bunch of flattery that none of the Jews believed one word of. It's all these little happy, you know, fancy lawyer, orator kind of words to make Felix feel really good, but they didn't think that they were getting great peace through Felix or prosperity being brought to their nation. That was the last thing they thought Felix was bringing. But right now, they're collating forces because they're trying to take on Paul. He was the enemy they thought that could be beat. Felix couldn't. So you say what you need to say to get what you need to get. "And so we accept it always in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness." Verse 4, "Nevertheless, not to be tedious to you any further, I beg you to hear, by your courtesy, a few words from us. For we have found this man a plague, a creator of dissension among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarene." So he begins now his prosecution against Paul. Go ahead, brother.
He might be just overselling a bit, but still, that's the right thing to do. God expects even Christians to respect those in authority. So here in the United States, we've lost respect for authority. Mm-hmm. You'll talk about the president. Any one of the presidents over the last 5 or 6 we had, we talk about them like a dog. Mm-hmm. But that's not what God wants. God wants us to kind of hold our tongue and try to be respectful as we can given the situation. But that said, we wouldn't have done that in Iraq. So I'm saying, you try that one time, and you won't do it again in his day, because he was a brutally wicked leader, but the people feared him. So we got to have that same respect, even as David had for Saul. David said, "You hunt me down like a dog. Now, Lord, deliver you into my hand." And my men or my boys told me to lay it on. And after that, I got a piece of garment here, Saul. But you're the Lord's anointed. So guess what? I got to respect.
Right, right. And I think, was it a week or two ago, we talked about that where Paul said, he quoted the Old Testament passage, "Do not speak evil of a ruler among your people." And I think we did a good job in discussing that in application to America today, that there is some application to that, because when we do, then we lose respect for authority in general, and then anarchy is the replacement to that. But look at what Paul does in comparison to the flattering Jews. In verse 10, it says, "Then Paul, after the governor had nodded to him to speak, answered, 'Inasmuch as I know that you have been for many years a judge of this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself.'" And so we see Paul handle that in a mannered way, paying respect where respect was due. Notice he refers to it in terms of the office, right? You have been a judge of this nation, and I'm thankful that I now have an opportunity to answer before the judge of our nation. And so that's in stark contrast to what the orator, the smooth speaker, was trying to do with his words in chapter 24 and verse 2 and 3. Good comment, Brother Ross. Yes, uh-huh. That's a great comment. That's a great comment because, you know, human nature hasn't changed, right? Humans still are the same. And to see humans act this way is not a strange thing because humans still act this way today. It's a living word. It still teaches us that God knows all men. He doesn't need us to tell of what's inside us. He knows all men, as it said of Jesus. And yes, Jesus, in contrast to all men, is like light and darkness. And that's what John says in John 1, that the light shined in the darkness. The darkness did not comprehend it because he was so different than us. And so we are to be drawn to the light and called out of darkness. Anybody else? Right.
Because of his greed, and obviously he was a very cruel man. Charges were brought, and Caesar heard it.
Right. See, that was how the Jews really felt about him. You know, they didn't want to share that now. That wouldn't have been helpful. But he was not effectively leading the Jewish nation, and so, yes, Rome said, get Felix out, put Festus in. Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Yes?
Yeah, to Christina's point here, when you're telling a lie, you got to think of all this stuff, and you got to whisper and gossip, and you got to keep working to make sure everybody's on the same page. But that's not the case with the truth, because you can tell the truth for 1,000 different times, and it's still coming out.
That's right. You know? That's right. Good. So back there in Acts 24, good comments, everybody, good comments. But there in Acts 24, the case they begin to bring against Paul is interesting because they don't immediately just say, well, here's what the first, you know, domino that fell about Paul. You know, he brought some Gentile into the inner courts in the temple. I mean, that was how it all started first, you know. They thought he had done that. What they do is they just start off with these general kind of statements that really can't be proved one way or the other. They don't have evidence or witnesses there to prove it. They just say, we found this man a plague. What does that exactly mean? A creator of dissension among all the Jews throughout the world. And so so you're essentially saying he gets in a lot of religious disputes. He's like a debater. A ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. So they're saying that he is some denomination, some group of the Jews called the Nazarenes. This is their charge they bring before him. That wasn't true at all, but yet this is the way that they're painting the story. So verse 6, he even tried to profane the temple, and we seized him. So now they kind of get a little bit closer to what originally was the ruckus. There was someone there that thought they spotted Paul earlier in the day with some Gentiles, and that he brought them into the temple inner courts. Well, that was never established at all. So they didn't say he did profane the temple, but they didn't say he didn't either. They phrase it as he tried. Again, how do you prove that? So a lot of this is just lawyer talk, using a certain language a certain way so that you can get brownie points. So we seized him and wanted to judge him according to our law. But the commander Lysias came by and with great violence took him out of our hands, commanding the accuser to come to you. So this goes back to what Christina was saying. Everybody's putting their own spin on the story to make themselves look better, right? Lysias said, I had to come and rescue Paul. The Jews are saying, we had Paul under control, but then the commander Lysias came with great force, you know, knocking people over, bullying everybody. He was hurting us. You know. So everyone's putting their own take on the whole thing because of human nature taking over with sinful men. They do and say what they want to say. Well, by examining him yourself, you may ascertain all these things of which we accuse him. So, anyway, that's a pretty short and succinct, you know, prosecution, but it is highly lacking in evidence and witness testimony. I mean, it's just non-existent there. And I don't even know how one would even escape a court hearing today with him being laughed, you know, not being laughed out of the courtroom with just something like that and say, that's all we got to say. You can go ahead and ask him, and he'll say the same thing. You know.
This law that they're defending is obsolete, it's ended, but yet Paul is dealing as if he's still under it through respect for it and try to get him to the gospel. He did things that the law demanded. I mean, we need the power to have the was circumcised. You think about him having his head shaved. These things were under the law, but yet he was teaching against the law, but he had to take it one step at a time because they were so against the truth of the gospel. But by no means was he going to give up on the gospel.
Right.
That was part of his argument, but he had to bring it along with him to get him to understand the city.
Good class, everybody. We're going to stop there.